You know, a lot of people assume these days that with DNA tests, the work of catching bad guys has become a whole lot easier. All that's needed is a punch of a few computer keys that reveals a match, and police go out and arrest a criminal. But it's not that easy, as KCUR's Peggy Lowe has uncovered in a startling new report. Her story involves a brutal 1999 attack and rape of a woman just west of Westport who nearly died as a result of stab wounds. In 2010, DNA test results revealed the identity of the attacker. Still, 5 more years passed before he was arrested. Here to tell us about this story, which she has chronicled in a piece on KCUR.org, is Peggy Lowe. Peggy, always good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
And also here is CJ Janovee, who originally reported on this case for The Pitch back in her pitch day. CJ, nice to have you too.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
Peggy, as I said, this was a stunningly brutal attack. Can you give us, you know, the broad outlines of what happened one night here back in 1999?
Sure. Up front, I'll say, first of all, this is a pseudonym that we gave this woman because she didn't want her identity known. And also, this is a graphic story. So that's just a warning to our listeners. It was August 1999. And as I wrote on KCUR.org, this woman, who we call Juliet, faced a woman's worst nightmare. A stranger, a man, was in her bedroom. He woke her up and he had a large knife and he said, "Be quiet and I won't hurt you." And at the time, the thinking was, if you went along with this kind of thing, not saying yes, but at least trying to save your life, you know, you'd be okay. So she tried to do that. She tried to connect with him. He puts a pillow over her face and begins stabbing her. And she said, I thought you weren't going to hurt me. And he said, well, you saw my face and now I have to kill you. So it went from there. Finally, she began to fight back and he did leave and she drug herself to her neighbors and she ultimately survived. But it's been a really, really, really hard 17 years.
And that journey continues with her health and trying to manage all of that, right?
It absolutely does, because he nearly killed her.
I mean, I was going to say, it was stunning to me reading the story that she survived.
It was stunning. And basically, it was for a couple of reasons. Number one, she has a 4-year-old daughter. And she was like, okay, I have to live because I've got
to live. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's a mom. You know, that's a real fierce force right there, I think motherhood is. So she did it for that reason. But literally, she has chronic pain. She was cut. Her, you know, muscles and nerves in her neck were cut. Her stomach, her face. I mean, just everywhere. And she's, you know, essentially she can't work full time because of all this chronic pain.
Now, this is a broad aside here. You said a second ago that the thinking back then was to sort of go along with the thing to survive. Has the thinking changed?
A bit. I know that, you know, some advocates, they go both ways.
Okay.
Some people say, you know, say no, say no, say no, say no. But don't fight. Stay alive.
Right.
Certainly is, you know, the key factor here.
You know, fast forward back to this case, more than a decade to 2010, Peggy, and authorities get a DNA match identifying the perpetrator. First, why did it take 11 years to get to that point?
Well, so the attacker's DNA was not in the FBI's system. It's called CODIS. That's an acronym. And he was charged with a felony in 2008. He had a domestic violence charge in he's from Olathe. So this was in Johnson County. Once you have a felony charge, then your DNA goes in the system. So that was 2008. He served about 7 months. By 2010, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation notified the Kansas City, Missouri Crime Lab, because they had done the work on the rape kit, and then Kansas City Mo notified Kansas City CAN, who failed to do anything. They just let it lie, and that was in 2010. So it took another 5 years when, you know, our Juliet here was suffering, and this criminal was out reoffending, essentially.
You know, the thing that struck me about this, again, not covering police like I used to, I just thought when you have DNA on somebody and you're entered into the system that there are just matches flying around all over the place. And if you have your DNA of a potential perpetrator out there and someone would match it, it would just happen because of a computer keystroke thing.
That's absolutely the way it's shown on television,
yeah,
isn't
well,
it?
Okay.
You know, typically by beautiful people with rock music playing in the back.
Yeah.
But it's not that way at all. And what this case really does show is that DNA is a fabulous law enforcement tool. And it's an amazing, you know, biological and high-tech system. That said, it always comes down to human beings to do the shoe leather, to, you know, put the pieces of the puzzle together. there and follow up on any leads that this tool provides.
And we'll get back to the story in just half a second here. CJ Janavi, you originally published Juliet's story back in 2009 in The Pitch. How did this story come about? How did you get onto it?
I was the editor of The Pitch at the time, and our reporter at the time, Nadia Flum, was the person who did the reporting on this story. And I knew Juliet. I knew her story. It was
you knew her personally?
Yes, I did. And it was about 10 years after this attack. So The Pitch published the story in 2009, and we knew that Juliet had reached this sort of decade of survival, and she really felt that her story could help other victims of crime. You know, sort of seeing her serving as an example of you know, survival and recovery after this kind of assault. But there was also the news aspect of it was that after her attack in 1999, there was from her rape kit, there was sample of the attacker's DNA. They didn't know who he was, but at the time, Wyandotte County, for the first time ever, charged a John Doe with the crime based on the genetic profile of the assailant.
And why did they do that?
Because the statute of limitations would run out after 2 years. And at the time, federal rules were allowing prosecutors to file charges based on the genetic material, even if they didn't know who that genetic material belonged to.
What an interesting idea. Yeah. So it just kept the case alive then for potential prosecution down the road.
It kept that statute of limitations from expiring. And so that's why, you know, all these years later, prosecutors were finally able to charge this person once they knew who the John Doe DNA actually belonged to.
Did you meet her back at that time then? Were you spending time with her as that story was getting put together because you knew her?
Nadia Flum did the reporting and spent quite a bit of time with her. If you at KCR.org, we've actually linked back to The Pitch story. Which is you sort of have to know the right search words to find it now in the archives. But there's quite a bit of Juliet's life detailed in that story by Nadia Flum.
You thought, CJ, that it was important that KCUR update this story. Why?
Because they found the guy and he's going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And to fill in another blank there, too, CJ felt that there was something that went wrong within the system, as did Juliet. She felt that, too. And in talking, I've known her now for 2 months, and she always wanted this story to be about the systematic failure in law enforcement. It's not just about her. And so CJ brought it to me, handed me this amazing story on a silver platter, and said, we need to look at who screwed up and find out what happened and continue making this case come to life.
Well, let's talk about that and what went wrong here, because in your words from the story, Peggy, Juliet's case exposed this major flaw in the way American law enforcement tracks DNA matches. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, this is really fascinating. I could barely find anything about this. There's essentially around like two experts on this in the country. And the guy who...
Frederick Bieber
is one of the guys. He's a medical professor at Harvard. The other guy, his name is Rock Harmon, and he's this legendary prosecutor from Oakland, California.
With a name like that, he ought to be legendary.
Isn't it awesome?
Yeah.
His email's like DNA Rock. You know, he's just, and he's legendary too because, for instance, he was one of the prosecutors on the O.J. Simpson case, and he's just been a leading guy in the field forever. And I reached out to him, and he said this has been such a problem with the FBI database forever because, you know, essentially these matches get missed, and they get missed for a number of reasons, whether it's an old case and it falls between the cracks, whether it's police ineptitude, you know, a lot of reasons. And he said there has to be a tracking system so that when a match is made, you've got to track the system and make sure this is followed up on and get this guy arrested.
In this day and age, that seems entirely possible.
Doesn't it, though? I mean, this is just such a huge flaw in a system that's pretty amazing. Now, he has set up, he's created his own, like, you know, web-based software that does this in the Alameda County in Oakland. And he is trying to get California wanted to do, a statewide system. There's a couple other places in the country that we didn't write about. I think there's in Massachusetts and a guy in Houston I talked to as well. So there's a couple pockets of it, but it's not the stuff you'd read about. And then the other part is that the FBI doesn't really count the statistics for whether or not any of these matches lead to convictions and prosecutions and guys in jail. So it's no one keeps track of this.
But certainly one of Frederick Bieber's points here is that what happened with Juliet was nothing unusual.
No, and he says it's like, you know, this DNA match system is like a pipeline. And so the pipeline goes from, you know, corner to corner, and there can be a leak in the pipeline. And in this case, it was the Kansas City, Kansas police.
You know, again, you know, what did KCK police say, Peggy, about all the time that was lost on this case and what happened on their end of this deal?
They say they just don't know. I talked to the chief of detectives there, and he said, you know, he thinks that because the detectives had retired and moved on, you know, it was already, you know, such an old case that it just probably the match got sent to somewhere in the bureaucracy, which he likened to a black hole, and it was just lost.
Okay, so even then, and your story documents this, after all of this and all these issues that have cropped up in this case, it was something of a miracle that the case ever got resolved at the end of the day. It took the determined work of two young prosecutors to get it done. Who are they and what did they do?
Their names are Christiane Bryant and Jennifer Tatum, and they're young women who decided to take on a bunch of cold cases in addition to their other work.
They're in Wyandotte County.
They're in Wyandotte County, yeah, in Kansas City, Kansas. And this story was on their radar because of the pitch story from 2009. And because I would add, you know, Juliet tells this story so articulately, and it's such an astonishing story. And I think that the reason this all finally came to light and there was finally some justice in this case is because the power of Juliet's story was incredible. And so, and then she found someone named C.J. Janovy, who actually got this published in The Pitch and then here in KCUR. So because this was on the radar of the prosecutors, because there had been the media attention, they took up this case and bing, they opened it up, found the match. There you go.
So the upshot of all this then is that about a year ago, Juliet gets a telephone call from a Kansas City, Kansas police detective who told her what?
We got your guy. We found him. Come in. Well, they actually didn't. In the initial phone call, they didn't say, we have him. They said, please come in. We need to talk to you. And they bring her in.
And she assumed it was just an update or whatever.
Yeah, she's like, it's an old case. Maybe they're actually going to care, you know, for a while. And they're going to get my new address or my new email or whatever. And so she comes in and she tells her story. And there's a bunch of guys in the room, including the chief from Kansas City, Kansas, who was like, you know, kind of a rookie at the time of this case and was one of the people involved. And she tells a story. And then they finally say, we got the guy.
Huh. And her reaction was?
Well, does he show any remorse? And they said, well, he's glad you're not dead. And she's like, well, that's nice because some days I'm not so glad I'm alive. But apparently he doesn't have a lot of remorse. There's some sort of religious thing. This wasn't documented in our piece either, but he was praying over her at some point during this attack. And I think he feels he's been forgiven somehow.
Huh.
I know.
And so I guess the million-dollar question is, how is she doing today? Where is she with her life?
Well,
and how is her daughter?
She's a pretty amazing person.
I get that impression.
Yeah, she got her doctorate at KU in December, and she works part-time. And
she got
her
doctorate. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's really hard.
In what?
I can't recall. Some sort of social policy, perhaps, something like that. And then her daughter's 21, living on her own, doing really well. And I've seen a difference in her in just the 2 months that I've seen her. She also feels very strongly about the term survivor and the term victim.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this incredible, incredible piece in the New York Times Magazine this weekend that I would really encourage people to read. She feels this term is simplistic and makes people either pity her for being broken or expecting her to be a superhero. The name of the piece in the New York Times Magazine is The Forced Heroism of the Survivor. And it's just a fabulous read.
Huh. CJ, what do you think about how she's doing these days?
I saw her briefly when she was here talking to Peggy, and she looks great. And, you know, I just, as someone who listened to these stories on the radio this morning, I have to reinforce what Peggy says about the power of her story and her willingness to tell her story. It's it's a graphic story. It's a very difficult to listen to story, but she keeps telling it, and she keeps telling it honestly.
What do you hope comes out of this thing, CJ?
Well, I certainly hope that police investigators will remember to check the databases and will be more vigilant about, you know, paperwork that may be at the bottom of a pile somewhere. I have to, think that the two district attorneys in Wyandotte County have really set an example for how to, how to be vigilant and how to be proactive and how to work harder to make sure these people get justice.
You know, I remember my time covering police, and, you know, the pressures that they face aren't like pressures that people in corporate America face, and that is, you know, they're judged to some degree by how many cases they clear, how many cases they solve. And certainly from their vantage point, you know, new cases, you have a better chance of solving than cases that are 10 years old. So you see what the issue here is, that the incentive to go after old cases isn't nearly as great as the incentive to go after the new ones.
Of course not. They're very hard, you know. Yeah. And in this case, there was some evidence missing. Prosecutors confirmed that for me. So they didn't have everything they probably needed to move forward in trial. And that's the next step here, Steve, is this guy who we've been talking about, whose name is Jabre Burnett, he will be sentenced tomorrow. He's a 38-year-old man from Olathe. And in a plea bargain, he has agreed to basically serve 17 years.
Wow.
So that happens tomorrow morning.
Peggy Lowe's full story on this case is available right now at kcur.org. Peggy Lowe, thanks for coming in. Thanks for the great report. CJ Janovy, always good to have you here. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.